question from me, from my side, mm-hmm. so for the benefit of others.
Yeah.
And the question is, recently I've read an article which was saying, by now you are probably familiar with the buzzword hygge, the Danish life hygge. I will explain.
Spell it.
H-Y-G-G-E. It is Danish word, Scandinavian word.
Oh, okay.
But it becomes a trend. The Danish lifestyle trend that Americans obsessed over last year. But if wrapping yourself up in chunky neat blankets and eating all the pastries you could lay your hands on didn't fix your woes, you might find the secret of happiness in the Japanese concept of ikigai. And ikigai is essentially about finding your purpose in life, or a reason for being, the thing that gets you out of bed each morning. So ikigai could also be the secret to longevity. So question is, do these concepts really can bring happiness proper into lives of human beings, or these are other misguiding concepts bringing us nowhere?
What comes to mind is the concept of conditional and constitutional. Because it's easy to say in a general way, like, we want to live a life that has meaning or purpose. But how that's defined, it can be defined differently in terms of conditional activities, constitutional activities. So when it's defined from a conditional point of view, you know, people will say, like, I live for my children. That's my purpose. That's what gets me up out of bed every morning, you know. Or husband, wife, parents, children, patriot, and country, and businessman, and money. You know, an old joke when someone said, you know, I wouldn't be doing this if I didn't believe in it. And they say, oh, what do you believe in? Making money. So, there's a Bhagavatam sloka, Narayanam mayam dhira pashyanti paramartita, jagadhanam mayam lubdha kamukha kamini mayam. What is at the core of someone's vision? And by that, you know, what is in their heart? And then, conditional heart, constitutional heart. We're dealing with conditional at first. So it's saying, in this sloka, a businessman sees everything as an opportunity for business. Like on this road, so many people drove by on this road for so many years, and the Banok man, he saw, I could take that side of the road, put a little something there, my economy doesn't, and he made a successful business. Then other people tried to imitate him or whatever. But he saw you see that on many roads in many places. He saw trees, like jungle growth, actually, and thought, oh, I could do something there and make a business. So his way of seeing things, his purpose, what's driving him, and I'm just using him as an example, not him personally, but such a person. He's seeing everything that's coloring his vision, how he views everything. So when he defines purpose, a businessman is saying, my purpose is to make money. And then what I do with that, that's another thing. But that's my, that's what gives my life meaning. And it says, kamuka kamini mayam. And one full of calm or lust is always searching for erotic opportunities, seeing everyone and everything is their potential, they're being judged from that standard. But again, in the beginning it said, Narayana mayam bira pasyanti paramartina. Paramartha, and that's interesting because artha means meaning. But here it says, paramartha. And Gurudev, what did he like? Something, maybe it was in Chaitanya Shikshamritam about paramartha. I can't recall clearly, but I remember him singling out this idea. Because here, paramartha, now we're going over into constitutional consideration. What is ultimately meaningful? What is ultimately beneficial? That will define. It's, in this sense, ironic that some modern-day scientist thinkers, like Stephen Hawking, for example, he'll say, when we discover the original source of everything. I'm going to use that within our circle. So when we discover that, you think, that will help us define what is the purpose of our existence. So that's interesting because it could be true from a material point of view, from a spiritual point of view. Some would take it, another thing, when we understand the nature of the source of everything, it will help us more deeply understand who we are, what our purpose is, like that. The almost comical aspect of that is like, don't hold your breath. here we are, however long we've been into this thing, whether you say hundreds of thousands of years or millions and billions of years, trillions of years on the, let's call it the human project. And the implication is up to this point, nobody knows. So not a good record, right? So up to this point, if we follow that line of thought, nobody knows why we exist, what our purpose is, what we're doing here, and we can't wait to get, a text message from Stephen Hawking the moment he figures it all out. But he's dependent upon the Hadron Collider smashing atoms together and other things. Someone will say, no, that's not what they're doing. All right, okay. Quarks, fill in your tech buzzword, whatever it is. But I'm saying there's a humorous aspect to this with the implication, so up to this point, nobody knows, right? Because without knowing that, how can you know? But it's ironic in the sense, the Upanishad saying, yasmin vigyate sarvam eva vigyatam bhavati. Try and know that one thing upon knowing which everything is known. Like the, what they call the unified field theory or the theory of everything, which for the scientifically inclined, I repurpose that. I'm borrowing that and repurposing it and saying from a Gaudiya ontological perspective that Vedanti tattva vidas yajnanam advayam paramatmeti Brahmeti, Paramatmeti, Bhagavaniti Shabdite. The unified field theory in Gaudiya ontology is Brahman, Paramatman, Bhagavan. And again, Paramartha. What is the ultimate meaning? We also want to know that. In that sense, the theistic inquiry and the scientific inquiry, they want to answer this question. It's of the utmost importance to both. We could say their approach is different, and often the conclusion, one theistic, one atheistic, not discounting that there are those who, scientists, who hold a theistic point of view as well, and theists who have a deep admiration for science. But it's how we define that purpose. This,
you know, that say, I want to do something meaningful with my life.
Right. And ostensibly, to realize the self, one's potential. But I like to use the words reality potential with the implication that there's realizing one's potential as an exploiting unit in the world of exploitation where jivo jivasya jivanam, one living being lives at the expense of another, runs in parallel to Darwinian evolution, survival of the fittest. But then again, there you say, what does it mean, fittest? The one who's intellectually superior or physically? Intellectually fit, physically fit. So, survival of the fittest. Again, it all these things need defining. But there's that idea. As an exploiting unit, I will. Establishing myself as an absolute center, then I will try and expand the circumference of my exploiting capacity. And in this way, realize my potential. But potential for what? For exploitation. We can get color, you know, try and give it softer, prettier names, but that's what it comes down to. But as the poet Shelley wrote in Ozymandias, look upon my kingdom, ye mighty in despair. I met a traveler from an ancient land who told me, you know, something quite peculiar that he saw. And in the midst of the desert was a monument to a great king, Ozymandias. But in time, so much time had passed, the statue was broken, so that just from, say, the waist down and the legs is there with the legend or inscription. But the arms are off in one place, the head is off to the side in the sand. He said, but when you look at that head in the sand, there was this arrogant sneer on the face. And he said, I think that sculpture, he captured him well. Whoever this man was, I think he captured his essence. We know the portrait photographer, the sculptor, that those who are extraordinary, they can capture the essence of that person. And interestingly, in portrait photography, the great portrait photographers, as a consensus, they say that the person, and we're talking about the great people, not that other people aren't great, but those who are famous, they say, they're always trying to hide themselves. You know, like persona. There's a persona they adopt as a famous person, so, and they want to put that mask on and hide behind it. But the great portrait photographers, they have a way of, they're dealing, talking with them, asking them to do their thing. They're taking those pictures where they're maintaining the persona that they want to present to the world. But the experts, at some point, they will get that person to take off the mask and they'll get a picture of them as they actually are. There's an art to that. So the narrator in the poem, he says, this sculptor, I think he captured the essence of this Ozymandias king very well, because he's showing this disdain for others and this arrogant sneer. And he said, the legend says, I am Ozymandias, king of kings. Look upon my kingdom, ye mighty, in despair. And he said, but when you look, all you see are sands and sand dunes and just sand, no kingdom. So even if one adopts the strategy that they will find meaning and purpose as an exploiting agent, either selfishness or extended selfishness, this is where it ends. Or as Guru Maharaj liked to quote the poet Gray's elegy, Thomas Gray, the boast of heraldry, the pomp of power, all that beauty, all that wealth e'er gave, awaits alike the inevitable hour, the paths of glory lead but to the grave. And the language of the Bhagavatam, we have Shreyas and Prayas. Prayas means what is perceived as being immediately beneficial. And Shreyas, like Shabde Pureya, Tasma Gurum Prapadyeta Jigyasu Shreya Uttamam. What is ultimately beneficial? Paramartina. Ultimate meaning, constitutional side. What is our constitution? Sanatan Goswami, the beginning of the so-called Sanatan Shiksha, Mahaprabhu's instructions to Sanatan Goswami, begin with Sanatan Goswami saying, Ke ami kene amoy jarita bitroy. Who am I? And why am I suffering from the threefold miseries of material existence? If I don't know this, iha nahi jani kemona hito hoy, then how can I know what is beneficial for me? So he's adding this qualifier. If you can't answer this question, then everything that comes after that is questionable. And what is Mahaprabhu's answer? And first of all, we should say, for those unacquainted, threefold miserable conditions, adhyatmik, adibhotik, adidevik. Adhyatmik, self-induced misery, and say unforced errors, adibhotik, suffering inflicted by others, can mean, you know, like we have to deal with the mosquitoes and such things, but other people too. Adibhotik, others. and Adidevic and so-called natural occurrences, disasters, you know, tsunami, earthquake, hurricane, flood, whatever, it goes by different names in different places. And I've always found it interesting that in insurance policies, the legal language in English, an insurance policy, when they say things we don't cover, because after Hiranyakashipu, they had to like get the language really tight. So they say, here are the things we don't cover. And the phrase they use, it's old style, but still it says, acts of God. Now maybe, I don't know if they say that anymore, but that's how they used to write it. If it's an act of God, we don't cover that. Have you read the seventh canto about Prahlad and Nrisimha? Yeah, we don't cover that. If Nrisimhadev is going to come out of a pillar, we don't cover that. So nicely, Sanatana Goswami Prabhu is the Bhakti Siddhanta Acharya. He's setting the table for Mahaprabhu, saying, who am I? And why am I suffering in this way? If I don't know this, then how can I know what's hitohoi, means what's good for me? It's very simple, but it's on the money, as they say. And what is Mahaprabhu's answer? Jive swarupoi krishnara nitya das. Krishnara tatasta shakti beda bed prakash. So think, this is Krishna himself as Mahaprabhu answering this question. Do we think it's a good answer? One answer that could be given, an all comprehensive answer, the first thing that we need to accept, embrace, and deal with. Why do you say, just straight, Jiva Swarup, the Swarup of the Jiva's real form and real purpose and real meaning. What is that? Krishna, Nitya Krishna Das is an eternal servant of Krishna. Not a sometime servant of Krishna. Eternal servant, that is your actual identity. And what is, further, Krishnara tatasta shakti, jivas are, because you think, well, then how did I, then what happened? If that's my eternal position, then what is this that I find myself in? Ayi nanda tanuja kinkaram patiramam bhusame vabam budho. I'm Krishna Kinkar, servant of Krishna, and I'm drowning in an ocean of forgetfulness of that fact. And exploring all sorts of substitute identity, substitute purpose, substitute meaning. As I told the sarvupadi vinirmuktam tatparatena nirvam. Having my senses do anything and everything but serve Krishna. Hrishikesha, Hrishikena, Hrishikesha sevanam, bhakti ruchite. So how did this happen? Krishnara tatasta shakti, because jiva is tatasta shakti. And although this sounds visual and GPS-like, really we have to remember we're talking about consciousness. So when he says the jiva, the locus, what is bhakti? Locus standi of the jiva, where is it located? On the outskirts of the Swarup Shakti. But remember, outskirts of a particular type of consciousness. Right? That's how we navigate the spiritual domain, even the material world. The Om Bhur Bhuvah Swah plane, right? is gradations of going from gross misconception and illusion to subtle misconception and illusion, right? And then above that. So he's saying from that marginal position, what does margin mean? It's very simply expressed here by Mahaprabhu himself. He is answering this question. That means situated between two planes. What is the tata? Tatas, when he says tatasta shakti, why use that word? Tata means like the bank. Like, what is that song we sang, you know? Radha kunda tata kunja kuti, you know? That's another one. But anyway, tata, Ganga tata, Navadvipa koladri raje. On the banks, what is, and why is that? Because think, why did he's answering this question that is extremely important, succinctly, then each word has some significance. Just like in poetry, you know, why it's the hardest thing to write, they say the novel, short story is even harder, can't have any unnecessary information, but a poet, every word has to count. He's saying, because jivas are tatastha shakti, on the margin between the mundane and the spiritual, like, and it's almost imaginary. Like, where water and the land meet, where is it? There's an almost imaginary position where it's not land, not water, or land and water. And they're saying, that's the position, jiva. Krishnera tatastha shakti, beda bed prakash. And has some similarity and difference. Similarity, qualitative similarity, sat chit ananda vigraha. But quantitative, magnitude is minute, right? And on account of that minute magnitude of consciousness, can be overwhelmed by illusion and forgetfulness of his actual position. So, yes, we seek meaning, we seek purpose, but for it to be fulfilling in the truest sense of the word, it has to be based on constitutional identity, which means atma, jivatma, the spiritual side of things. Otherwise, on the conditional part, as we mentioned, whether in Ozymandias and Gray's Elegy, all of this will vanish. As Gurudev said when we're departing London, he's saying, I was happy in my village life, and Guru Maharaj's representative came from the Math. He said, saying, you know, your mother is nothing, your father is nothing, this world is nothing, it will all vanish. And Gurudev said, it like ruined it for him, as he thought. I couldn't deny that what he was saying was true. I was happily going along, and then he's saying, and at the time, with Gurudev's classic humor, he said, he came talking this nonsense. What is the nonsense? You know, Atmagyan. Your mother is nothing, your father is nothing, this world is nothing, it will all vanish. Then what? What will be your position? So when we're searching for meaning and purpose, we have to, as Guru Maharaj says, dive deep into reality, into the permanent plane, permanent identity in the permanent plane. Yes.
There is actually another question, online question, but I cannot reach it on the my browser. It's just okay. Disappeared. But I have another one.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I will ask another question. As soon as we touch the subject of poetry and the language of great poets, which is more complicated to express something in a condensed form, I want to ask the question referring to the British poet William Wordsworth.
Wordsworth.
Yes. In the Lucy poem.
Yes.
Poems by William Wordsworth. The poet is saying, "The stars of midnight shall be dear to her, and she shall learn her ear in many a secret place where rivulets dance their wayward round, and beauty born of murmuring sound shall pass into her face."
Yeah.
So the question is, the beauty of the sound emphasizes visual beauty. Is sound always over form? Or it happens only in mundane reality?
Well, first of all, just for those who are unacquainted, Guru Maharaj, you know, ever the diligent, attentive student, he recalls English poetry he studied in school and, you know, what the Christians told about Jesus and Christianity and the Bible and, you know, German philosophers, and it's extraordinary that he remembers all of those things. But as Madhava Maharaj said about Guru Maharaj, whether he reads the newspaper or the Vedas, it's the same. So when he reads, you know, English poetry, what they think, he highlights the parts that he can use as a bridge to Krishna conception. So here he discerned from this, he's saying, sound beauty contributed to eye beauty. And what the poet is saying there, because poetry is one of the hardest things to translate into a foreign language. But what the poet is saying about, maybe it's Lucy Gray or someone, or the girl in the poem, is he encounters her, she's in the forest, and she's sitting next to a stream, a brook, means a little tiny stream. And we know the water moves, and it makes a very pleasant sound. So he's saying, it would one thing to behold this beautiful girl, he's saying, but the beautiful girl, and then next to the sound of the river, he's saying, the sound of the river makes her look even more beautiful. So he's saying, sound beauty contributed to eye beauty. And with regard to the sequence, nama, rupa, guna, lila, from sounds, the enhanced beauty of the form of Krishna. But I would have to point out that Srila Guru Maharaj has said, interestingly, he's saying, in this world, sound is like the subtle element. When we're speaking of earth, water, fire, air, etc., like that, sound. And that's, or it's the subtlest representation of the spiritual in this plane. Whereas, he said, it's the lowest in the spiritual world. It's the least. And the highest there being aroma, which is interesting. And this plane, if you study the Panchabhuta, the five elements, you'll see that it's only when there's earth, right, the grossest element, then aroma comes. See, but in the spiritual world, there's an inversion. And this is, can be a very deep subject matter. I'm not going to go into it now. It's beyond my capacity to do so. But it's noteworthy that in support of what Srila Guru Maharaj is saying here, you look at the concluding chapters of Chaitanya Charitamritam, Mahaprabhu and his divine madness enveloped by the heart of Srimati Radharani, his mad with the fragrance of the aroma of Krishna. That said, no less than Krishna himself says the whole creation is maddened by my aroma and fragrance, of which the fragrance of this world, punyo ganda prithivyam cha, Bhagavad Gita, when we smell the wonderful flowers and things, and where they have almost a hypnotic effect upon us in a vibhuti sense. Krishna is saying, I'm that, I'm the fragrance. But beyond that, trigunatita, Krishna is saying, my fragrance, you know, drives everyone mad. Right. He's saying, but the aroma of my beloved drives me mad, meaning of Srimati Radharani. So, and we hear early on in the Bhagavatam about the Kumaras, Tasyaravinda Nayana Shipadaravinda, Kinjal Kamisra Tulasi Makaranda Bayu, Antargata Swavivarena Chakaratesham, Sankshobhyam Akshara Jusham Apichittatanvo. By inhaling the aroma of Tulsi mixed with the aroma of the lotus feet of the Lord, they're completely transformed. Right? But this means, back to Hrishikena Hrishikesha, spiritual senses. And what qualifies something as being spiritual? It's not something to be demonstrated in an objective sense, like we might say, aromatherapy. But we like to borrow that. Because you'll say, this aroma will have this effect upon you. And we're here neither to promote or demote, but just to observe. So we'll say, this one gives this type of mentality, this gives that type of mentality. So here we're saying, the mixture of the aroma of the lotus feet of the Lord with Tulsi, his lotus feet being covered with Tulsi, manjaris and leaves, that entered the consciousness, the core consciousness, the heart's deep core of the four Kumaras, and they were transformed. So, what was it about sound?
Is sound always over form?
Over?
Mm-hmm.
No, it's... over would not be the right word. Here we're saying it's, from one point of view, you can say it's, it has a certain primacy about it, as in Nama Rupa Guna Lila. It will precede. Here we're told, you know, sound beauty contributed to eye beauty, ear beauty contributed to eye beauty, but if we want to follow that, then we're saying nama rupa, from sound the form appears. In that sense, it's almost like a catalyst or a it's serving. I wouldn't say over, but assisting. Any other question?
Yes, from our online viewer, Robert Grant.
And it almost tells you that because if you consider our present situation and conditional existence, and what are we told? We shall focus on it first, the sound. One of the examples we always gave, we heard from Srila Prabhupada about, you know, when a person is sleeping, how do you arouse them? But by calling them. And even though they're deep in a dream, forgetful of their actual identity, they start hearing that sound within the dream. Then they enter like half dreaming, half waking state. And then following that sound, they come out of the dream into a fully awakened state. And the parallel is uncanny, because it's similar to what Guru Maharaj said. And upon that awakening, what do you know? You know who you are, what your name is, your identity, and, oh, I'm late for something you have to do. They're saying, in the spiritual world, they think, how does that help me? He's saying, once one is awakened to their identity, they know who they are, where they are, and I'm late. I added the I'm late part. But in other words, they know what they must do all instantaneously upon that awakening. Yes.
Robert Grant is asking, isn't any original non-conscious physical cause of origins of the universe and life by definition be limited in the thinking of these so-called scientists and philosophers to ultimate purposes such as natural urges for propagation and survival? Your aspiring servant, Rameshwara...
Can you read it again?
Rameshwara Dasa.
Slowly.
Isn't any original non-conscious physical cause of origins of the universe and life, by definition, be limited in the thinking of these so-called scientists?
What in their thinking?
Be limited in the thinking of...
Delineated.
No, there is no word delineated, so...
Yeah. I don't have my glasses on. Spell it.
Be limited in the thinking...
B-E, then limited?
Yes, B-E, limited.
Okay.
In the thinking of these so-called scientists and philosophers to ultimate purposes such as natural urges for propagation and survival.
Let me see it. Maybe I can read it. I can make the text
bigger. You can zoom it.
Yeah. I just want to make sure I understand before I answer. Okay, isn't any original non-conscious physical cause of origin in the universe and life, by definition, limited in the thing, ultimate purposes. Hare Krishna. There are different approaches to these type of ontological considerations. And I just wanted to say first that Srila Guru Maharaj once mentioned about a Bengali lawyer who was like, his reputation was like that he was the best. But he was also a notorious drunkard. And so one day he came in the court and he started presenting this case to the judge, and like, it was just unassailable. It was so perfect, his representation. But his assistant was like pulling his cloth, and he's going like, what? And he said, that's their position. And then he went, oh. And so he said, so, Your Honor. He said, this is what they could say. Then he defeated that. So Guru Maharaj's point was saying, if you really want to defeat the opposition, first try to understand how it is they think like that and could believe that. That will be helpful. If we approach them without, in this sense, respect, like Mahaprabhu's teachings, we see how he deals with Venkatabhata, the Buddhists, Prakasananda, others, even the ego of Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya. Of course, there, that was a little bit of a slap when after so many days, Sarvabhauma says, I know this is deep stuff, but, you know, nod your head, or, you know, if you understand what I'm saying. And Mahaprabhu said, I understand Vedanta perfectly. I just don't know what you're talking about. But still, so I just want to, just before, yes. So two things to understand. What is, we like to say, our position, you know, the Gaudiya, right? And then what is the position, as he says, of so-called scientists or other types of modern thinkers? Like Bhaktivinoda Thakur will show in Krishna Sangita, as an example, he'll say, whatever the Vedas say, I just accept that in toto. But I understand modern thinkers, you think the Vedas were, the Bhagavatam was written, you know, 800 years ago, or the, he said, I'm not going to argue with you about chronology and time, but I will still prove to you that what is found in the Bhagavatam is, there's nothing superior to this. Let's not get hung up on dates. Whether it was 5,000 years ago, 500 years ago, that's irrelevant to this discussion. I've also mentioned that it's interesting, the universal appreciation for Bhagavad Gita, east, west, north, south, you know, physicists, religionists, atheists, everyone finds something in there substantial. So, and my point was that a rational person could, and rational thinkers, I mean, they also appreciate it. They could say, well, wait a minute. It says right here in the beginning, Sanjaya Uvacha. Sanjaya, you know, Dhritarashtra Uvacha, Sanjaya Uvacha. Dhritarashtra's asked, Sanjaya's answering. Sanjaya, by his own admission, our understanding, he's not there. So how is someone who's not there, he's saying Krishna said this, Arjuna asked that. In the end it says, Vyasa Prashadat Srutavan. Right? By the mercy of Vyasa, he's saying, so, by some mystical process, mystic power, he was privy to this conversation between Krishna and Arjuna. So from just a purely rational point of view, we just say like, all right, we don't accept that, forget it. But they don't. Why? Because the substance, the content of Bhagavad Gita, the substance of Bhagavad Gita is so great and overwhelming that the method of transmission is irrelevant. That's the point. The method of transmission is irrelevant, the way it was acquired. Even, who is it, Borges, or one of these great writers, he said, he was praising another writer saying, he didn't have to prove anything or demonstrate any fact. He said, what makes his power is his authorial voice of just what he says and the authority with which he says it. Therefore, we accept that. In the literary world, they go, oh, what a beautiful, wonderful comment. If we say that on the spiritual side, they go, what? Don't you need to verify, to prove the factual nature of these things, and so many things? But we see as an example in Bhagavad Gita, just what is given there, the substance is so overwhelming that no one even bothers to consider the method of transmission. So these are two different types of culture, subjective culture and objective approach to things. Right. So from an objective point of view, you're not going to convince some of something that is utterly subjective. Then it would just be supplying a particular amount of information. I remember once Srila Sridhar was saying in response to like the subject of reincarnation. My dear friend suggested to him that knowing the sort of comprehensive, convincing answers that he gives, if he would deal with this subject, it would be a wonderful thing to publish. And Guru Maharaj gave an interesting answer to time. He said, if someone has no faith, or if someone has a little faith, then hearing a simple example, they accept that. And think about it. Like, we're impressed when people, you know, as Prabhupada said, speak with bombastic language, scientific theories. You know, they're talking about physics, quantum mechanics, all these things. Like, but do you think that that's like non-understandable to Krishna? Right? That Krishna go, wow, that's really deep. I'll have to think about that. No. So Krishna, he could give a very complicated answer. Right. Who could come up, if you're saying like, what's something that we could say that would really just convince people? What say you, Krishna? Krishna, I've been thinking about this for a long time. You know, I've expanded in the heart of every living being, so I know what everybody's thinking at every moment. I think I've got something. And so you look in the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, and what does it say? Very simple things. You know, as a garment becomes old and worn out and you throw it away and put on a new one, so the body, you know, dehi nos manyatai dehi, etc. You know, embryonic to baby, toddler, child, teenager, adult. Having given up, showing the soul's ability to survive the birth of one type of body, the death of another body. At the time of death, dhiras tatra namu, he'll take another one. Those who are dhira will not be disturbed by such a thing. So anyway, my point is, Krishna is giving very simple examples. So Guru Maharaj said, if someone has faith, even a little bit of faith, hearing these type of examples, they'll accept it. If someone doesn't have any faith, and now I'm paraphrasing, but he said, you can give them, you know, a mountain of evidence and they won't accept it. So then we see the critical thing that is necessary is faith. Shraddha Shabde Vishwasakodhe Sudrida Nishtoy Krishna Bhakti Koyali Sarva Karma Kritahoy. That belief, there's this one thing, back to the unified field theory. I mean, if I just believe in this one thing, culture this one thing, then everything is done. But now more to the point, that's the intro. But I think the answer will be shorter. But at the but it reminds me of my famous flight from Beijing to New York, which I'm sure the Chinese devotees are very familiar with. But sitting next to me is, that's why this is important to why I say these things. Sitting next to me is a Chinese teacher, but he's teaching advanced computer science at one of the leading universities for that subject in America. And this isn't an exaggeration. So he's supremely qualified. Having shared some, you know, amusement there for the in-flight entertainment, we're having a friendly exchange. But when I realized what his qualifications were, I said to him, can I ask you a few questions? I thought, well, this is a great opportunity. Different things I've been thinking about under the influence of Guru Maharaj's ontological method, I can run it by him, see how he responds. So that's when I said, and I was thinking, because coming from Thailand, everyone knows my favorite flower here called Lilavati. In Bengal, they say Goloka Champak, Champak, variously, you know. So it's very, the aroma is wonderful, the texture is wonderful, it looks beautiful, everything. So I asked him, I said, can you say or deny with absolute certainty that the original source of all aroma, such as these, has no olfactory capacity? In other words, cannot smell. I want to ask, and it's a simple question, actually. I'm saying, can you say with absolute certainty the original source of all aroma has no olfactory capacity, is not capable of smelling that aroma? Because people like to pose all sorts of peculiar questions about divinity. And he said to me immediately, his defenses were down, there's no one around, no one knows what we're saying, there's no face to be saved. But he said, as you have worded this, I say, can I deny that with or discount it with absolute certainty? No. And then I wanted to jump out of my seat because I said, then I don't need to ask you any more questions. Because you've opened the door for theistic culture, and I can reframe this question by, for each one of the senses, I can do it for the auditory sense, for tastings, all the different senses. So in other words, you're allowing for the possibility that the original source of senses and sensuality, not limited to, but including eros, is in the original source of everything, has personality, senses, and sensual tendencies. You're opening the door for that sort of culture. So in the first, the Bhagavatam is the book of Krishna. I like to say that because Prabhupada called the 10th canto the Krishna book. But we're told it's the body of Krishna, and so it's Krishna. Right. And the first three words, if it's three, janmadyasya yataha, like Vedanta, the floral Vedanta yielding to the fruit Bhagavatam. What's going to come in this Bhagavatam? The fruit, the Vedic desire tree, without the fruit can be misleading, hard to identify what its purpose is, as any tree without its fruit. But the flower comes in the form of Vedanta, and Vedanta has janmadyasya yataha, the very first line of the Bhagavatam, janmadyasya yatonvayad itaratas. So what does Srila Prabhupada take? Referring to Vishwanath Chakrabarti Thakur's commentary, saying this janma, it seems to be saying, and it is, that it's defining who is the Krishna, ultimately, the Supreme Absolute Truth, but saying, from which everything is coming. Janma means born, but emanating, it means different things. Janma Adi would normally mean, you know, birth, manifestation, etc. But interestingly here, drilling deeper on that, Prabhupada says, Vishwanath Chakrabarti Thakur says, here, this is a reference to Adi Rasa. Now Adi, instead of meaning etc., means like the original. So another way of reading this is saying, the origin of everything is Madhura Rasa. What does that mean? That means Radha and Krishna. And all of these tendencies, what is there in the original is in everything that comes from the original. Freud had, you know, the erotic principles, the driving force behind everything. And he tapped into something there. And we're being told in parallel in the Bhagavatam, Eros is the driving principle of spiritual existence. Adi Rasa, Madhura Rasa, why is it called Adi? It's the original. All the other rasas are satellites or clients of Madhura Rasa. And whether it's expanding outward from the spiritual world or being pervertedly reflected into this plane, it is the driving principle. I just saw this verse today, where it's a famous verse in the Bhagavatam. After Krishna separated himself from the gopis and plunged their hearts into the depths of separation, why? Because he thought, then they will yield the superior quality of prema. That's Krishna. He's saying, whatever it was before that, if I separate myself from them, they'll go deep. And I am always hankering for that type of loving substance. But when he returns, it says, tasam abhirbhuch chori smayamana, that means smiling, smayamana mukambuja, with a smile. And now Krishna's smiling. He returns and he's smiling. Pitambara darasragvi, wearing his beautiful golden yellow lightning dress and a garland. Then it says, Sakshan Manmata Manmata. And what did he look like? Cupid's Cupid. Manmata Manmata. Cupid's Cupid. Madan Mohan. Only he can break the stranglehold that the perverted reflection of the erotic tendency has on the jiva souls. Why Madan Mohan is the Sambandhagyan deity, Sanatana Goswami, must come first, because what? This Cupid has a stranglehold on everyone and everything here, the whole animation. Krishna, as Madan Mohan, he's so beautiful that Cupid is bewildered. Everyone else is bewildered by Cupid. Cupid is bewildered by the beauty of Krishna. And as Gurumar said, and what does that indicate to us? Saying that sort of sensual possibility is there with the Supreme Absolute Truth. reality, the beautiful, Shyamasundara Krishna. So, for those who think or are accustomed to think that the world, the objective world, is more or less infinite or unlimited, like the trillion, trillion stars. And then on the one planet amongst the trillion, trillion, it's this blue planet, the Earth. And on that planet, there's conscious living beings. And among the conscious living beings, the conscious elite, the humans, if they experience a drop of pleasure, right? They get lucky on a good day, they experience a drop of pleasure. So in their scenario, the objective world is more or less limitless. Then the conscious elite is so minute in comparison. And then, so understand here, sat, chit, ananda, existence, the objective plane, huge, consciousness, very the conscious elite, the very few, and among the conscious, a drop of happiness is a rare achievement. What a bleak scenario. You're like, talking about what gets you up out of bed in the morning. That's not a whole lot to look forward to. Right? But that's the bad news. The good news is, the Vedic perspective is just the opposite of that. The huge, infinite, all-accommodating substance is anandam, or happiness. The central conception of the infinite is Krishna. Right? In human-like proportion, but as Brahma is all-accommodating, Paramatma all-permeating, Krishna is all-attractive. Everyone is being drawn toward the central conception of the Absolute Truth. By what? Compelled by His beauty, charm, sweetness, love, affection. So if we hear, and what scientists will accept is that we say, you know, that love and affection is the ultimate substance? You go, oh. You know, the ultimate reality is beautiful. Oh, we have elegant beauty in science. No, not like that. Actually beautiful. Like compellingly beautiful, seductively charming. Oh, we're seduced by scientific theory. Not like that. That the ultimate reality is anandam, anandamurti, anando brahmano vidvan. No, the supreme Brahman, the supreme reality, is happiness and ecstasy personified with the full spectral range of sensual possibility. That's astonishing. So here, anandam, that is the ultimate substance, then consciousness, then the objective world. What is Guru Maharaj saying? It is like an iceberg floating in an ocean of consciousness, the whole objective world. And they want to deal with that and measure that. Establishing themselves as an absolute center and trying to establish, to increase the circumference of their exploiting capacity in this objective world, which is like an iceberg floating in an ocean of consciousness. So I don't know if I've answered this question. I have to look at it more carefully. But these are a few things to consider. And I think the one thing I said does address it by saying that whatever tendencies you find here, we will hold that it's a perverted reflection of the original. So, but at least a rational type thinker should be able to understand by what they observe here to trace those things back to the original. Why should they think that the original source of all gender is gender neutral or genderless? Why not consider a male aspect, a feminine aspect, Shakti and Shaktiman in Sanskrit terminology? And neutral has its place too, but to think that positive and negative have emanated from neutral is not necessarily sensible. Anyway, it's a vast subject, and we'll try and visit it at some other time, and I'll look more deeply at the question. But I hope I gave something. Hare Krishna.